Tom Johnston, Eskimo Music, Dance, and Religion. And welcome, folks, and thank you very much for coming. And we have a map of Alaska. And the pale blue up here is the Inupiaq Eskimo, 11,000 speaking Inupiaq Eskimo. And down here, 17,000 speaking Yupik. Now, this Yupik Eskimo language is different to this one and cannot be understood by these people. And this is the only place where Central Yupik Eskimo language is spoken. But the Inupiaq language, of which there are 11,000, is also spoken by 17,000 Eskimos in Canada and 34,000 in Greenland. So it's a language that's gone right across the top of the world. And in Canada and Greenland, they call it Inuit. Over here in Siberia, there's about 1,000 speaking Siberian Eskimo language. Okay, so that briefly then is the language situation. And it's the Eskimo of the north that hunt whales. They have village communities that make skin boats and help hunt the whales. Down here it's mostly salmon fishing and caribou hunting. And tonight I'm going to start off by showing a videotape of an Eskimo festival, a dance festival, and then I'll talk a little bit about Eskimo culture and religion, and then we will learn to do a couple of Eskimo dances, and then we'll learn to do a couple of Eskimo drum rhythms. So, first of all, let's look at the videotape for about 10 minutes. This is to get you oriented to the kind of folk.
Takes quite a while to try to mount these skins. We have to make them out of cottonwood.
I wondered how you did that.
This is the wolf dance of the messenger feast, held at Nome, Inupiaq Eskimo.
They say that's the reading. You're reading.
Yeah, the feather in the mouth is the spirit.
Feather.
The wolf.
They say it's reading for you. You think out of reading.
What is he doing right now?
They're just playing with their head. And then when they say kia, they have to...
These are dance mittens.
Just like this one, all of them. Every time they say kia, they have to dance some other way. Pretending that they
hostility. The wolf carries all the aggression that is taboo in Eskimo society.
I thought the little kid's gonna get scared. Like a swallow to your nest and come out with the wolf feather. David does have a different sound. I don't know those Mike and Francis and Gabriel and Pearl. I really couldn't tell you how they'd be apart. You see, something that unbelievable.
Their return and the return of the songs that go with them has inspired the dancers and their apprentices to revive some of the other traditions that have fallen from use. by the night of the
Now we move to Canada. Canada and Greenland. Canada and Greenland is not group music dancing. It's always a solo drum dance. This is Canada. And women have this singing style where they hum and grunt into each other's mouth. And the two together make one song. It's called Akajayit. The Inupiaq, the eagle wolf dance. Then we went to the Yupik, who kneel and wear masks and wave dance feathers. Then we went to Greenland, the solo drum dance. And then we went to Canada, where the two women do the humming duet.
Question on that.
Yes.
What happens, would it be different if only one person was doing it? Is there an amplification by the other one?
Only two women do it.
Well, my question is, what would happen if one did it? Would it sound?
It would only be half the song.
Well, okay.
Yeah. The song is the composite.
I see.
And you can hum or grunt or whistle or make clicking noises, and they make very original sounds that you wouldn't believe are human.
Do they ever do quartets?
No, just always two, young women and old. Akajayit, it's called. Now then, in Alaska, subsistence was always very rich because as the sea mammal passed through the Bering Straits, they're confined and you can catch hundreds of walrus or whale or seal. And so large communities arose, and at one time there were 1,000 people living, 6,000 people living at Point Hope right here, because we found archaeological digs showing 600 contemporaneous home sites with an average of about 10 people per home site. That's 6,000 people 1,000 years ago. 6,000 people supported here in the Arctic. Incredible. No supply ship, no planes. And it's because the sea mammal was so rich. And so they developed shaman and dance teams and group ensemble dancing. Now in Canada and Greenland, the subsistence is not like that. It's sparse. Usually you have a band of 25 people following the caribou, and they're always mobile and nomadic. And they go to the winter camp, and they go to the sea camp, or the summer camp, and then they go to the spring camp. And so you had the solo drum dance because you didn't have enough people to make a team of people making dance marks, a team of people playing the drums, and a team of people doing unison group mime dance motions. So in other words, the music style and the dance style, you can almost say it's determined by the ecology. It's environmental determination. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about Eskimo culture and religion. Just a few notes here, not too much. And then we will do a couple of Eskimo dances, learn them off the video, and do one or two Eskimo drumming rhythms. First of all, we'll talk about the culture and the personality. As you know, every nation has a certain kind of emphasis in its personality or character. National character. The Eskimo are a people that have become accustomed to confined living. Large numbers of people in small spaces for long periods of time in the dark and the cold. And so they had to learn how to get along. Just try it sometime. So they developed something called amiability. It consists of smiling a lot and gift giving, cooperation, personal modesty, and a lot of sharing to minimize envy, and humor and wit. This humor and smiling is a social lubrication that helps them to get along with each other under difficult circumstances. We might also note a genetic fact that the Eskimo people tend to be short and rather chunky. That's an Arctic adaptation. For instance, in Africa, at the bottom of the Nile there, the Nuer, the cattle herders, are very, very tall and very, very thin, and they shed heat very easily. See? Eskimos retain heat. And up there, the rabbits are as big as dogs. And moose are enormous, like elephants. We see them all the time walking through our garden. The Eskimos are an egalitarian people. That means they do not have hereditary chiefs or social stratification. There are no aristocrats, commoners, slaves. And you have a question?
Yes, I do. When those two women were doing their thing on the video, there was a strong, how should I say, oriental look, mm-hmm. the eyes. Is there a Thai oriental?
Yes, Eskimos came across the land bridge from Siberia, and we find burials where all of the body orifices are filled with jade. Wow. Ancient burials. Same as in the Orient, same as the Chinese, ancient Chinese used to do.
Just one other comment, the dance where they kneel and using the fans remind me of the Japanese, you know, and they use fans extensively for their dancing.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we can make connections there with the Orient. We do know they came across the land bridge. So there's no authority figure. And they had jurisdiction system. There was no formal judge, no formal law. People work things out amongst themselves. All right, let's move on. There's a clear division of labor and sex roles. The women do the sewing, make all of the gut parkas so the men can go hunting, and the men catch the whales and so on. Amongst the Eskimo, there is a very high development of Arctic skills, like tool making out of bones. And women have, 100 years ago, women had a sewing kit that consisted of many, many different kinds of bone needles. Grandma's bone needle is very important because it enables the hunter to go hunting, and the hunter's hunting keeps the people alive. And in the folklore, there's many stories where the bone needle is magical. You know, the man eats six whales and then climbs through the grandma's needle to get into the house and things like that. Magical needle. Psychologists that have gone amongst the Eskimos, that have gone amongst the children and the adults, find a high development of spatial and orientation skills. That is, they can read maps upside down and analyze drawings. And you put them in the middle of no man's land in a featureless environment like the tundra or the flat sea ice, and they know the way home from the direction of the ripples in the snow or the way the clouds are moving or the way that bird flew or the direction the snow is fluttering down. They don't get lost. A white man can die today very easily 5 miles outside the village if it's snowing. He'll just walk in the wrong direction. Nobody will ever see him again. I mean, ask me, it's happened to me.
And does it make any difference in sex?
Just lucky. Hmm?
The girls do as well as the boys on there?
Both sexes do as well as... That's a good question, because it's the hunters that have to develop that skill. But Eskimos in general seem to have a good... There's a certain amount of training. For instance, they do very tricky string figure games. With the string, where they put the string down and pick it up again, put it on somebody else's hand, turn it inside out. Put it down again, pick it up, and you know, they've got a mosquito, and they go out of that, and the mosquito's gone. And they have a sled moving across, and a bird that, one famous one is the bird that hanged itself. So that perhaps helps towards training these children in spatial orientation. But of course, they become used to the snow. They have 50 different words for snow, according to whether it's hard and crisp, or new and soft, or whatever.
Excuse me, do they have a universal language? Eskimo language there?
We went through the language on the language map here.
I'm sorry, so, I missed it.
Yeah. Inupiaq here, Yupik here, Inuit in Canada and Greenland. Let's talk about child rearing. The child, type of child rearing they have is very permissive and tolerant and produces a worldview of a benevolent universe. The children, as I mentioned, are carried in the parka's hood, giving security and a feeling of warmth and attachment to the mother. Child rearing is very tolerant and permissive. They allow the children to explore and experiment. I see them playing with very, very sharp knives, and they cut themselves. But it's a system of trial and error. And they praise the child highly for the first catch, and they say nothing about the ones that got away. It's the power of positive thinking. Orphans are interesting in Eskimo society. There is widespread adoption of orphans. There is a certain amount of death by accident on the ice floes that detach and the men never come back. And so orphans are adopted into other families. Matter of fact, the Eskimo word for poor is the same as the word for orphan. But because of the permissive and tolerant child rearing and the attachment to the mother in the parka hood for 3 or 4 years, the Eskimo develop an expansive personality, an accepting personality. They're happy people, they're smiling, they're not suspicious, they're not terribly aggressive. There's a lot of anti-hostility and anti-conflict mechanisms in operation, like the humor in dance. And of course, this is to enable them to get along in large numbers in small quarters for long winters. The learning is by perception and sensory observation. They don't learn things formally and systematically. There's a lot of silence and a lot of deference to the skilled hunters. And so in schools where there are white teachers and white professors, we sometimes have trouble understanding the Eskimo students who will never ask questions and will never question you and will never speak up. And if they don't understand something, they'll stay without the understanding and not get the homework right. It's because in their culture they have that silence and deference. And you have to know this in order to be able to interact with them. We have to remember too that in the Arctic environment, there's a high price for not learning. So they're paying attention when the hunter is doing something, setting the traps or repairing the skin boats. There's no safety net in our culture. In our culture, if you don't get enough food, welfare will give you some stamps maybe. But up there, it used to be that if you weren't a skilled hunter, you were liable to die. To increase this sense of security amongst the Eskimo people, they developed a system of fictitious kin. Now, we know what kinship is, a real kinship, you know, your uncles and your aunts and your cousins and your grandparents. But there's a very ingenious system of fictitious kin that the hunters and the adults create to broaden their network support system. You have your hunting partner, and you have your trading partner, and your dance partner, and your joking cousin. And there's a lot of gift giving, and you have your gift debtor, the man that you gave a gift to that owes you a debt. So we have this network of reciprocal obligation. You have your name mate that you share a name with. And even two men who've shared the same women have a blood relationship for life. You have your crewmate in the whaling ship. And your song recipient that you wrote your song for. And your athletics competitor, and other numerous dyadic relationships that you build as you go through life, and you become a powerful man, not as in Africa by the gift of the gab and manipulation of your peers, but through your network of support. And these people will rally around you if you have an argument, or if you need help, or if you didn't catch and they did catch. Let's talk about the folklore.
Some folklore is compensatory. That means what is taboo in the culture, like hostility and aggression, is acted out in the folklore rather harmlessly. Now, some folklore, amongst other cultures, strongly reflects the culture. What you learn in the folk tales and folk songs and stories is actually what is real in the culture. It mirrors it. In Eskimo society, there is a strong emphasis on reducing conflict and hostility. And so the folklore is full of aggression, and the wolf carries a lot of that aggression and hostility. Also, there's a lot of bloodthirstiness. There's a lot of men and women biting each other's heads off and scattering the entrails across the riverbank and things like that. These stories are very bloodthirsty. Of course, in Eskimo society, women are used to cutting open carcasses and dealing with entrails all day long. And you go and stay in an Eskimo house, and there's going to be a caribou carcass over there and 50 more on the way. So no wonder that appears in the folklore. The folklore can be fit, the folk tales can be fitted into 8 categories. You can take almost any Eskimo tale and fit it into 8 slots. First of all, the first slot is there is a lack. There's something missing. You need food, or you need a wife, or something. The second slot, somebody leaves. The hero leaves. The mother, the wife, leaves. The third slot, they wander around for a while. Eskimos love to travel. They go to the rivers in their boats. Then the hero comes across a block, and this is the fourth category. A block, something that stops them fulfilling that lack or getting what the village needs. In the fifth category, they overcome that block by singing a song which has magical properties. The music, the song, is supposed to have a supernatural overcoming device that overcomes the impediment, and they fulfill the lack. Then the seventh category is they return home or to the village or return to the family. And the last category is a reunion. And you can take the simplest folk tale or the most complicated folk tale and fit it into these 8 slots, which is rather interesting. You can just take a tale like Mother Duckling on the frozen inlet, and she's got her babies and she can't get out. And so she swims down and she finds there's a tunnel down there, but the tunnel's hard to get through, and so she cracks out a little magical song, and then the young ones follow her, and they get through this tunnel, and they get out to the open lead between the ice, and they're free. They return to their natural environment. Or you can take a very complex one. Now, in many of the Eskimo stories, there are bad wives and good mothers. Everywhere you go, whether it's the knife stories, they tell stories with knife in the snow. Or whether it's the grandma's folk tales or the little folk songs that have a story in them with animals, where one singer sings one animal's part in a low voice and the other one sings it with a squeaky voice, the squirrel singing to the ptarmigan, "I want to marry you," you know. You get bad wives and good mothers. And we try to understand why this is. It's possibly derived from the traditional system about 50 or 60 years ago, where the boys were taken away from the family and put in the men's ceremonial house and lived with the men. They lived with the hunters and were raised as a group, rather like a kibbutz, by the men. So they suffered a certain amount of psychological mother loss. And then at the age of around 35 or 40, they married. But they don't marry a 35 or 40-year-old woman. They marry some 14 or 15-year-old girl that's been betrothed to them. Now, they suffered mother loss, and here they are in this marriage with this little girl who doesn't really know nurture and practices and is unable to provide the man with his mother loss needs, and so there's a certain amount of psychological dissatisfaction here. But the mother is the one, by the fireside, the oil seal lamp, that's making all of the clothes and cooking all of the food and plucking all of the feathers from the birds, and she is the good one. And one of the common dances amongst the Inupiaq at Point Hope, where I lived for about 6 months, way back in 1973, they have a dance called the Haughty Bride. And this girl is being wooed by three suitors who each bring a very beautiful ivory carved knife, each one more beautiful than the last, and offer it to the bride. And she rejects each one in turn very haughtily and does a little song and does a little dance and ends up choosing one of the sled dogs. She marries one of the sled dogs. Another origin of this also is perhaps his infanticide, where there used to be a shortage of women because some of the female babies perished, and this left a shortage of women at certain levels of the demographics, and so women could be pretty choosy. And there was a lot of fighting, used to be a lot of fighting and bullying amongst the men in a competition for the available brides, but that's another story. Anyway, in the folklore, we have the wolf carrying the aggression and a lot of bloodthirstiness and the grandma's magic bone needle that makes all of her clothes, and the boy walks along the beach and eats a fat seal and eats a fat walrus and eats a fat whale and goes home and can't get into the house door, so the mother, grandma, produces her magic bone needle for him to go through. He goes through the bone needle, and when he gets inside the house, his stomach bursts and everything pours out, and he's got enough food for the winter. Charming story. Let's talk about subsistence. An interesting aspect of examining the subsistence is the important role of women. Women make all of that important warm clothing and gut parka that keeps them dry and warm. And they cut up the carcasses and they store the food in underground freezers. And they are very valuable, and the men couldn't do what they do without the women. The men keep 50-mile-long trap lines. They go out and inspect for a day at a time. They don't eat during those 3 days on the trap line. When they come back, they eat for 3 or 4 hours, maybe 6 or 7 pounds of meat, and fall asleep for 3 days. they don't follow the same nocturnal diurnal rhythms that we do. And in the music, we see these eccentric, lopsided rhythms that reflect the kind of odd, eccentric rhythm of people who live where it's dark all the time. Night, it's all night for 3 or 4 months. You have a special dance and a special song in January when the sun comes back over the horizon. So the importance of women in the subsistence. They make beautiful tools. The men have very complex sets of bone tools and fish hooks and harpoons, and the women have very complex sewing kits, all made out of the local materials. Everything is used. Even the enormous jawbones are used to make archways for the houses, which are sod houses buried down under the level of the ground. And the skin bolts are 40 foot long and can hold 20 men. And they put them upside down on stilts to stop the dogs eating them in the summertime, and the women repair them. And the men belong to a whaling lodge, where there is a captain and crew members, and this provides brotherhood, and each whaling lodge has its own dances and its own songs. The dances are a historical repository. They don't have a library with all their history in it, so all their heroic adventures and comic stories and origins of the tribe and tales of the ancestors and the forefathers are kept alive in the dances, which are mimes. Every dance is a story. And white people can't understand the stories because the movements are often abstract, but they have an assigned meaning. So the common topics are legends and myths, animal behavior, and heroic or comic adventures on the sea ice. And the movements represent subsistence movements. The men are always looking at the horizon or hauling sleds or shooting or harpooning or spearing or rowing, and the women are always cutting carcasses or sewing. The dance movements represent something in the subsistence tasks and the division of labor. There's also a difference between the men and the women's style of dancing. Men stomp very aggressively using the fist. They'll put one fist back here and a fist here, and they'll stomp up and down, and they'll yell and hoot and holler, whereas the women bend and bounce at the knees, and everything's very, very graceful and very, very demure, and the eyes are cast down. The women's movements are curving and graceful, and the men's are angular and aggressive, almost pugilistic.
And it used to be said that when you met a stranger, you were out hunting, you met a stranger, and they were somewhat afraid of strangers. Each one would start jumping up and down and doing high kicks and other athletic displays to intimidate the other one. Like, you see how tough I am, you better not try anything. But they wouldn't actually get down to blows. It's a way of saving face. Rather, we perhaps should try that. The inviting in is the locale for dancing. One village invites in the next village. Point Hope invites in Wainwright. Pilot Station invites in St. Mary's, and Imonac invites in Alakana. And it's athletics, gift-giving, feast-giving, dancing, and singing with a lot of humor. Who can make the other team laugh the most? If they're smiling, they're not planning a revenge attack for the last blood feud. The dancers have a placatory function for the spirits. The spirits are capricious, and they determine next year's hunting success. The village could starve, so you must please the spirits. And you take the bladders of the seals and blow them up and sing to them and dance to them and put the bladders back in the ocean. And those same bladders will come back next year to be caught again. It's always the same seal. It's always the same bladders. And this is led by the shaman. The shaman is the priest and the healer and the mediator between you and the hunting spirits. He puts on a loon skin headdress with a pointed beak and dives to the ocean floor to communicate with the wailing spirits. And they wear these loon skin headdresses now in dances. And the shaman has visions that determine what masks. We saw some beautiful masks there. Masks come in categories. There's five categories of masks. One is very natural looking, used for everyday functions. Then there's unnatural human, with elongated or wide faces or just half faces or strange eyes. And then there's animal masks, the caribou masks, the raven masks, the walrus mask with the tusks on it. And then there's half human, half animal, representing the spirit within the spirit within that animal, the polar bear with its fur peeled back. And six, extremely abstract, used for highly religious functions. So the continuum from natural-looking Eskimo mask to abstract mask, some of which are the most beautiful works of art that are highly valued in the World's Museum, is a continuum of use from secular use to sacred use. And the masks are dictated by the shaman, who has a team of workers to make them. And it used to be that they were destroyed after the dances, which was a great shame because they are works of art. The Eskimos believe in a connectedness of all things. And of course we talk a lot about that at Holden, where man is dependent upon the animals and upon nature, and the animals come to the dance to be entertained and to be respected. And we study dance and music because it opens a door for us into the cognitive processes, the thought processes, and the worldview of people who have a society and a culture that's very, very different to ours. There's another reason, too, why we study other people's dance and other people's music, and that is it enriches our view of our own. We realize that we don't have the best music and the best dance, and that we are on the top of some kind of ethnocentric ladder, and the other societies are all ranked according to how childish or primitive they are. We learn that a very simple Eskimo song, pentatonic scale with just the drum, their only instrument, can be as important to them emotionally, just as meaningful to them in what it symbolizes, as one of our great operas or great Beethoven symphonies. It's all relative. It's cultural relativity. Anthropologists study the social context of dance and music, where it was performed and why, what kind of rites it goes along with. Is it initiation? Is it Thanksgiving for the harvest or the hunt? Musicologists study the sound, rather independently of the context. They measure the intervals and the rhythms and analyze the scales, just dealing only with the mathematical aspects of the sound, which are easy to measure. Going out, living amongst the people, and finding out about the social context is somewhat more difficult. Musicologists sometimes make judgment errors in coming to conclusions and findings about a music that they only hear and haven't been there to see what it's being used for. And then we have linguists who study song words and learn a lot about archaisms and history and migrations and so on from the language, what kind of words are in the language. And then museum curators study what the instruments are made of, what kind of materials, how it's related to the ecology, how the instruments are tuned. And today in many universities we have dance ethnologists, specialists who study the dance and the meaning of the movements, and whether the movements reflect motions that are considered to be acceptable and typical in that society. I mean, we all know that young blacks walk in a certain kind of arrogant, bouncy way, like they were dancing, right? You know, real loose, you know. And they dance that way too. Are the movements that are condoned in the society reflected in the motions of a society? Dance ethnologists study that kind of thing. And also, does dancing together in unison, this kinesthetic togetherness, does that instill a kind of community solidarity or community security among people? What do people get from dance? This is the kind of things that dance ethnologists study. Well, talking about dance then, and by the way, before you leave, there's an article here called Song Categories of the Yupik Eskimo, that's the ones in the south, and another article here called Drum Rhythms of the Alaskan Eskimo that you're welcome to pick up. And here's a book that's in the bookstore. I think it's selling for $11 in the bookstore. Inupiaq dance songs, and it has some photographs of Eskimo dance movements in the beginning, if you ever wanted to. And here's a little book, it's not in the bookstore, Learning Eskimo Drumming. And I and my colleagues have put out about a dozen of these books, which are used in the rural schools, in the Eskimo schools in Alaska, in addition to a bunch of scholarly stuff. Right now, we're going to watch David and Dinah Frankson of Point Hope, this very important whaling community here, show us how to do a simple Eskimo dance. And we'll watch it once through, and then they'll teach it to us movement by movement, and then the last time, we'll all do it. We'll stand up and do it. Okay? Let's do what we watch. These old people are about 80 years old, but they're still going strong.
Phrasing over there.
Sitting down playing this song is David Frankson.
Thank you.
Yeah. You want me?
You'll notice that interesting neck movement, rather like a turkey, like this.
This way, that means I paddle the boat. I'm paddling the boat. Then on the other side too, I paddle the boat. Then I take the oar and start to oar the boat. Then next I step over the kayak and I paddle the kayak. Okay. I stand up and start dancing. I dance while I'm dancing. I look over this way. Also look over the other side. Then I start dancing like this. The Blumira, that I don't know the English name for it. That's this. The Blumira Rama.
What is the English name for it? Have your feet together.
And
see, don't
turn
your knees bounce up and down. So you're going up and down like this.
Then,
right. So put your chairs back. Stand up. Face the video.
Doesn't mean anything. That's the end of the song. Okay? Then we dance it again. The same one. Yeah. Move this way a little bit. Yeah. Okay.
One hand to the other. Switch over. Okay, now I need four volunteers and play the drum, and the rest of you can clap. So, who'd like to be a drummer? I'd like to be an Eskimo drummer, like David, all right? Robert? And we've got another person over here. These are not authentic drums or sticks. The real drums cost $100 to $200, and they're made with from the membrane that covers the liver or the stomach or the lung. And they have to clean and stretch and scrape that membrane and put it over a driftwood hoop. And they're rather fragile and break easily. So, I go around the village schools giving drum clinics to the children, and we take a kit. We take some of these $3 embroidery hoops and a whole roll of airplane nylon, and we have the kids make the drums and learn the rhythms, and we fetch the elders in to teach us the dancing and the rhythms. We're going to play the one on the board along with the tape. Now we need a little bit of preparation here. There are three different note values here. There's this long note in which you count four. So whenever you see a hollow egg like that, a half note or a minim, you count one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. That gives you a long space between notes. In other words, it's a long drumming note. And notice the structure of the song. We have two lines of quick notes, and then a slow section, like a sandwich, and come back to the quick notes. And this reflects what's going on in the dance. You see, three quarters of the way through the dance, they're doing something slow. Like they're going on snowshoes through soft snow, hauling a heavy sled. And so you can actually see from the way that the music's laid out there, what is happening in the dance, speed-wise. All right, now the ones with the dots after them, you count three. One, two. And the ones that are just plain quarter notes, you count two. So it'll be like this. One, two, three. One, two, one, two, one, two, three. One, two, three. One, two, one, two, one, two, three. One, two, one, two, one, two, three. And you repeat that seven times. This line's almost the same, except you've got a different number of repetitions here. This dance is from Wainwright Village, a very well-known northwest coastal whaling village, and it was written by Weir Negovana many, many decades ago. This line here, you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, very, very slow. And you can actually see the dancers doing something very, very slow. And this line's the same as the top one. Right there. So we're going to have the Wainwright singers sing it and play it for us while we go along with this. Well,
except for the shot. What do you think? Well, it's a conclusion. I'm glad it finished. And dance the quad, it stopped drumming, you know.
Try and rewind.
just throw this out. When you start to rock, the sound exits. I mean, the
Okay, we're all going to clap. We're going to get it right, okay? Well, the
dance
is all
finished.
The drumming is very important to the dancing.
That drumming, you know.
If you have any questions or any discussion about this, has anybody been up there to Kotzebue or Nome or Barrow and seen some of this dancing?
My grandfather, but not me.
Question, I'm sure you're familiar with Michener's treatment in Alaska of the natives. Did you feel, if you've read it, did you feel he treated that probably the way it was?
I heard about the book and I saw it in the bookstore and browsed it, but I didn't actually read it. I'm much too busy reading the anthropology books that, you know, actually study the way things are rather than turning it into a novel.
But he made it quite a lot into, well, it's based on history, I guess, but the fact that there were generally two types, one with more of a more looking more like our North American Indians versus the others that have more of the shorter.
I don't know about the two types, but you very quickly learn the difference as you walk around the villages and the towns between whether you're talking to or looking at an Eskimo person or whether you're talking to or looking at an American Indian person. There's a great amount of difference in the appearance, in the behavior, in the interaction. And it's a great deal of difference.
What is the difference of the derivation of these two physically different people?
It's a long story. You have to go into archaeology and anthropology for that. But they came across at different times, speak different languages, have different origins, came from different parts of Siberia. American Indian came across and went all the way down to Cape Horn, south of Argentina. Another question.
Yes, what effect did the Alaska pipeline have on the culture of the Eskimo? Did it have quite an impact? Or?
There was a French television producer named Jean Mallory who came with a photographic team and asked me to join the team and went all over Alaska during the pipeline documenting these changes, 1974 to 1976. And there was a lot of prejudice on the part of the unions, a lot of pressure and discrimination to keep natives out of the pipeline jobs. The unions were very powerful, very violent, very difficult.
Successful, were they, in keeping
that,
the...
That again is another story. Natives did end up in pipeline jobs, as somebody mentioned. Natives did end up in pipeline jobs. Somebody told me that he knew natives that went to Prudhoe Bay and made $2,000 in 3 weeks. Who was that? Who was it told me that? Somebody told me that. Okay, any more questions? Yes.
What about alcoholism?
That, again, is another topic. I'm trying to keep it upbeat here.
Okay.
It's a sad story. A number of the villages have declared themselves dry. Bethel has declared itself a dry village. Tanana and Tanacross are dry villages. Any more questions?
What is involved in them doing that? Declare themselves dry?
The council, voting, democracy. The town council will meet and
they'll say we've had one homicide too many, and you know, so they'll.
Men only or women in the council?
A lot of the homicides is angry hunters under the influence of alcohol shooting each other, I suppose. But then you get this wherever the white man goes in and dislocates the culture, you're not going to expect to come in there and find normality. It's the same as when we brought blacks to this country and made slaves out of them, and then we complain about their family lifestyle, about the men that wander in and out of the family, and that it's always the mother-centered household and so on. And we say, why aren't they like us? Okay. Well, because we sold their wives and sold their husbands and sold their children. That's why they're not like us. So anyway, like I say, I'm trying to keep this upbeat.
Yeah.
Okay, so, well, it's a beautiful evening out there, and thanks so much for being a great audience.